Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside room, today's speaker is Gordon Jackson, and he will be doing an Inquiring Mind lecture entitled Beyond Apartheid, South Africa's Quest for National Unity. So, let's listen in.
The question then is, what is the likelihood of South Africa developing this sense of national unity? And maybe we could word the question as follows. Can a South Africa emerge to which all or the great majority of South Africans feel they belong, in which they share, and of which they are proud? Now, I don't need to talk to an American audience about what it is to have an identity as an American, but as we move into looking at a South African cluster of people saying, these people are so different, there are so many things that divide them, that is a paramount issue for them. And so that's what we will focus on in the time we have at our disposal this morning. I want to start out by looking at a quotation that I think is very helpful to give us a sense of what a nation is. If we're going to look at national unity, we need to say, well, what are we meaning when we look at the idea of a nation? And a political scientist named Emerson wrote that the nation is a community of people who feel they belong together in the double sense that they share deeply significant elements of a common heritage and that they have a common destiny for the future. The nation is today the largest community which, when the chips are down, effectively commands people's loyalty. So if we use that as a starting point, we can move on and say South Africa geographically, politically, is a nation, but is it psychologically a group of people who feel they belong together? And this is a very troubling issue for many South Africans. And I want to give you a quotation from the French author André Gide, who said the following: "To know how to free oneself is nothing. The arduous thing is to know what to do with one's freedom." April 1994 marked the culmination of centuries of struggle by blacks against white domination in South Africa. April 1994 marked the beginning of a new era, the beginning of a transition to genuine democratic rule in South Africa. There had been partial democracy in South Africa if you looked at it only from the whites' point of view. The white system in South Africa, white people in South Africa, had their own democratic system. You were allowed to vote, you were allowed to kick the rascals out within the white context. But that was an incredibly limited understanding of democracy. Now what has taken place is this transition to a much broader understanding of democracy. And with this newfound freedom, the question arises, what is going to happen? What are South Africans going to do with this new democracy? Are they going to be able to come to the point where South Africans as a group of people will say, we belong together? There are a number of significant barriers to saying this isn't going to happen easily, and I want to go through them. Clearly, there's overlap between them, and I want to identify them in what is perhaps a simplistic way to at least bring them to your attention. The first one that I would single out is the history of apartheid itself. The very nature of apartheid means separateness. The philosophy governing the country during the past 40 years or so prior to the election was that of keeping people apart, of having whites do their thing over here and having blacks, people of traditional African background, do their thing there, coloureds, people of mixed race, and in South Africa that has not been the offensive term that it would be here, people of mixed race doing their thing and people of Asian extraction, the Indians, doing their thing over here. In reality, of course, the grand design of apartheid was simply to protect white interests rather than to genuinely allow these other groups to develop their own cultural identity and to be protected from white domination, which was the kind of rhetoric you'd get from governments in justifying the apartheid scheme. But the very nature of apartheid system was to divide people, to separate them. And so you have an entire nation of people who have been brought up with this mentality of separateness. And if you could imagine what it would have been like in the South in the 1950s and the 60s with the civil rights movement, where you had a number of people whose whole worldview was shaped by the fact that we as white people are better, we are on top, we are going to be staying that way. Then you have circumstances changing so that you're being told this isn't going to happen anymore, this is wrong, it's got to change. And for a white Afrikaans policeman who might have grown up being given quite arbitrary powers over black people, where there was minimal accountability, to suddenly be told you are no longer going to be able to do whatever it is you please as a law enforcement person, you are going to be held accountable, and you may indeed be serving a black superior officer. Those are the kinds of shatterings of worldviews that for white people were traumatic indeed. For blacks, on the contrary, you've got the opposite problem of people who've been brought up being kicked in the teeth one time after the other, of being told you are inferior, you do not get the opportunities that white people are entitled to, and the only reason is that you're black. And for people who have grown up under a system like that, they too bear an incredible burden as they move into a new system of a society that is going to be trying to be much more equal and egalitarian. Because the apartheid system was comprehensive. Virtually every sector of life was separated. So I can remember as a child growing up in the community of Cape Town in a suburb where there were some colored people who lived, oh, maybe half a mile from where we did. But in terms of the grand design of apartheid, that was not acceptable. Those people had to be moved out so our area could be nice and clean and symmetrical in terms of this grand design. Only white people were allowed to live there. And so those people who'd lived there for generations were hoofed out in an instance that was repeated countless times throughout the country. Almost always, of course, to the benefits of whites. So whether it was residential segregation or whether it was in the realm of occupation, there would be separation as well, that good jobs were reserved for whites. On the mines, in the railways, wherever, it would be whites who would be given priority. Segregation then of certain jobs set aside to be sure we could satisfy our white constituents in giving them those opportunities. In the realm of education, there was segregation as well. My wife and I went to the University of Cape Town, and I remember quite vividly seeing a plaque posted in the library in the entrance to the main library of the University of Cape Town that said something to this effect. In 1957, the academic freedom of this university was taken away. That was referring to a piece of legislation in the late 50s that, in a wonderful piece of irony, referred to the University Extension Act. And the Afrikaners had a great knack for naming things in an ironic way. And if they limited academic opportunities, they would call it the academic extension thing, because that meant they were now going to ban blacks from going to these universities because they were going to set up separate universities for blacks. And blacks would have to go to universities in areas of the country where they'd perhaps never been before, but which were now supposedly their homelands. And the English language universities around the country said, we want no part of this. We want all students to be able to come to our universities. And they were not allowed to do that. And blacks could, for example, go and study at an English language university only with special permission from the government. And only if, for example, they were wanting to study in an area that wasn't offered in a black university. The basic idea is that academic freedom then was taken away from those institutions. They couldn't admit whomever they wished. And the second part of that plaque said, the academic freedom of this institution was restored in, and the date was left blank. And when I went back to South Africa in 1994, we visited the university with a group of students whom I was leading on a study tour, and I specifically went to the library to go and see if that plaque now had a date filled in there. And we couldn't get into the library, it was shut at the time we were visiting. So next time I'm back, that's on my list of things to do, is to see how the university has now reacted to the changing order in South Africa. Now all of this panoply of legislation that was in place, it covered everything from how you were registered as a newborn baby to where you could be buried. Everything was covered by legislation Those laws had long been fading and dying, and many of them had been formally scrapped and removed from the statute books before April 1994. Apartheid clearly was on its way out long before the election took place. It was a proven failure. The government itself had admitted that, and the question was what was going to take its place. But whatever is taking its place, the country is nevertheless going to carry this very heavy burden of what the apartheid system was doing to the country for the 40-45 years that it was in force. The next factor that I should mention is a lack of common symbols. I could unfurl an American flag right now, and those of you who are American citizens, I presume all or most of you, would have some kind of emotional tie to that piece of cloth. For South Africans, there is no comparable feeling of emotional tie to a flag. The South African flag is only a year old. It is a new flag that has been brought into place very artificially to replace the old symbol of white domination. Similarly, with the South African national anthem. When I was back in 94 with my group of students, we met a group of South African young people, a group of white college-age kids, and at a campsite, we were busy chatting in the evening, and for some reason, I overheard what our students were doing. They'd begun singing the American anthem, and they were doing so with pride, lustily, and at the end of this, it was now the turn of the South African guys, they were all men, to sing the South African anthem, and they began doing so with the words of what had been the traditional Afrikaans anthem translated into English, but it was the white anthem that these guys began singing, and they got to about the end of the first verse and gave up in sheepish embarrassment. They had absolutely no commitment to this, and it was fascinating to see echoes of what I remember growing up as a child, feeling this really isn't my anthem. I get the impression this doesn't belong to the whole country. And what's more, it isn't even an English-speaking anthem. It comes from the Afrikaans people who are in charge of the country. And so you find that anthems, flags, those symbols that are at the core of people's relationship to their own country are lacking in South Africa. A vivid example of this comes at the time of South Africa's re-entry into the Olympic Games in 92, the Games in Barcelona. At that stage, things were very unsettled in South Africa, but change was at least far along enough that they were going to allow South Africa to participate for the first time in decades. But the tricky question was, what flag are you going to fly under? Come in and do your thing under. Can't use the South African flag, that would offend a great number of the black athletes. So what they did was to compromise and have the Olympic flag. What national anthem are you going to use? You can't use the traditional white anthem. Nor could you use what has become a black anthem, the words Nkosi Sikelel may be familiar to some of you. This is an unofficial anthem, was at the time of this entry into the Olympics, but you couldn't use that at the risk of upsetting the political balance. So they compromised and they used the Ode to Joy instead, and that was the Olympic tune for South Africans. Now, you say, isn't this all incredibly odd and nitpicky? For South Africans, these are in many ways life and death issues because they have been so divided. For Americans, your symbols are very clear. Yes, you may fight over aspects of them as to whether we should have a constitutional amendment to forbid flag burning, but there's no doubt about the nature of the symbol itself. For South Africans, that has been lacking. A third thing I would mention would be economic factors. And I don't want to go into details here with lots of figures. Depending on which figures you read, you find differences of the extent between the gap, the extent of the gap between whites and blacks. But all the figures you look at point to an enormous differential between the earning capacity and the actual earnings of whites compared with blacks. Even over the past decade, where there's been a swelling of the black middle class, there is still overall an enormous gap between the earnings and the living standards of blacks and whites. And to put it very simply, whites typically are rich, blacks typically are poor. Now, that's oversimplifying things. But if you look at the big picture, clearly that is the gap that exists. This means, for example, that things like housing, things like educational opportunities, things like health care have always and continue to benefit blacks, to benefit whites at the expense of blacks. So you could go to any typical community in South Africa right now and you would see most whites there living at the standards that you in this country are accustomed to. Most blacks in South Africa, and there are plenty of exceptions, but the great majority of them would live in standards that you would typically associate with third world countries. There are some appalling slums in South Africa, and they continue to grow. And one of the disturbing things that my students and I heard when we were back there visiting in one of the slum areas was to be told the rate at which those slums were growing on a day-by-day basis, that thousands and thousands of people were flocking from rural areas into a kind of slum land that our students were repulsed by. And the question came, why are these people coming to these terrible, terrible conditions? And the answer was even more disturbing than what we were witnessing. It is that the conditions in the countryside are even worse. People are rational beings, and people don't do stupid things, typically. And so if you're going to move from a countryside area into a vast urban sprawl where there's no running water, where there's no shelter, you're going to have to make your own hut with whatever scraps you can find. If you're going to be doing that because it's better for you, it's very sobering for the rest of us to realize how much worse your prospects would have been in the rural areas. And it was that sort of poverty that left our students quite numbed. They came away horrified at the sights that they saw, people in incredibly crowded hostel situations, which had been designed for men who were migrant workers, maybe 16 men in a building, who had now been able to bring their families in. So you now had 16 families living in a building designed for 16 men, literally taking turns, shifts in sleeping in these buildings because there wasn't enough room for all of the people in there. And then you'd see in the midst of poverty like this, such incongruities as a TV set in a building like this. So there were incredible gaps that our students saw and which continue to remain in South Africa. And I want to come later to the question of poverty. There are all sorts of figures I could supply you with about the gaps in, for example, power supply. The electrification of the country is, by African standards, very good, but it's the whites, once again, who are the main beneficiaries of that. Many blacks just do not have electricity in their homes. They don't have waterborne sewage. They don't have the kinds of amenities that Americans typically take for granted. The kind of poverty that has resulted has inevitably taken a toll on the stability of the country when it comes to crime. Crime is the single biggest worry I have when I take students to the country. And as part of their taste of the South African experience, they were robbed in Johannesburg, and we were lucky that none of our people got hurt, but we had couple of other thefts that occurred with our young people, one of them an attempt at purse snatching, which we managed to foil, but in another case, one of our students had a camera stolen. And crime seems to affect South Africans on a day-to-day basis. What white South Africans are very fond of doing, and every time we go back, we hear the stories from our South African friends of how incredibly extensive the crime is, but also how very violent it is. There's much gratuitous violence. So they'll not only come up to you and take your purse, they might very well stab you in the process as a signature mark of what they're doing. So there's a great deal of very violent, angry crime. But if whites feel they're entitled to complain, and they certainly are, it's very much worse for the blacks. There are so many more blacks in South Africa who present targets of crime on payday, on trains coming home from work, people bringing whatever valuables they may have from a shopping trip may find themselves victims of crime. There's a great deal of murder, there's a great deal of rape, a great deal of theft. One statistic, Johannesburg last year experienced 4,000 carjackings where people at a traffic light or wherever had someone come up to them with a gun and you hand over the car keys very, very quickly, unless you want to do some Rambo thing of taking on a person who is pointing a gun at you. When my wife and I go back to South Africa and we're driving around, we know the rule now at night is you do not stop at red lights. You treat it as a four-way stop, see if there's anything coming, and you move through. Because the last thing you do if you're in your right mind is wait there for a potential hijacker to come and take your car and perhaps your life. Because they're not courteous criminals, it's quite common for someone to come take your car and just shoot you for the fun of it. That is the kind of threat to stability of the South African order that is a very serious problem, and it comes directly out of the economic situation. Another significant barrier to coming up with any sense of national unity, of course, concerns the diversity of the people. And I want to show you some figures here that are a little out of date, but they nevertheless point to the kind of diversity that exists. Here you have the home language of South Africans. And the reason these figures are out of date is that they are based on pre-94 census data. And before 1994, the government... before 94, the figures were based on what was regarded as non-homeland South Africa. Some of you may be familiar with the idea of the homelands, where many of the blacks were consigned, as it were, and they were regarded as no longer being part of the South African population. And all the official government figures that were put out from Pretoria, the capital, said, those people aren't South African citizens, so we don't count them. And so the figures you have here are very skewed in some ways, but they nevertheless give us an indication of the diversity of the languages. So here we've got some European languages that are spoken by whites. In, this would be 400,000, Portuguese, 600,000. Which I don't think it's quite that many, Italian. And then you get into some of the Indian languages and then some of the black languages. Please understand, we're not speaking here about different dialects. These are quite distinct languages. So with Venda, you've got a very different language from Ndebele. And with the Swazi, you've got a different language from that of the Tsonga. And then the Tswana, you've got a different language from South and North Sotho. Now, these languages are related, but you're really speaking about people who would write and speak in different ways. And there were, when we were back there, conversations about what is the official language of South Africa going to be after the election, because English and Afrikaans had dominated as the only official languages. We don't care about any of these black languages. Now, in a spirit of egalitarianism, people were saying, we are going to have 11 official languages. And to try and think of that being a workable proposition, try and imagine what it would be like in this country if you counted English and Spanish and then the next 9 most dominant languages and said, all this country's business is going to be done in those 11 languages. You're asking for absolute chaos. And I think in practice, you're not going to find that occurring. But here you have the total number of languages. South Sotho, then English at about 2.6 million people speaking English as their home language. Xhosa, 2.8. Afrikaans is a very large group because there are the whites who speak Afrikaans as well as the colored people. Many of them have as their home language Afrikaans. And then the largest single ethnic group is Zulu, which is very similar to Xhosa and to Swazi. They can understand each other. They're regarded as separate languages. Yes, Paul?
Could you just guess at what the number would be if they did count the homelands for the Zulu language?
The Zulu language would be this figure. The one that would be bigger would be the Xhosa and the Tswana language groups, because those were among the languages that had gone independent, or the areas that had gone independent. Venda as well was independent. But Zulu would certainly be the dominant one.
Still.
Yes.
Zululand,
we needn't get into the complexities of this, but Zululand never became, or I should say KwaZulu, never formally became independent of South Africa. Chief Buthelezi had always said, I'm going to fight apartheid from within by being part of the system, but by not fully accepting the system. And that made him very unpopular among many blacks in the country. But that's to digress. I give you these figures to show you the language diversity. Let's look at population figures, and these are more accurate and they are more realistic. Africans, and I'm speaking here of black Africans, one always runs into problems of terminology when one is dealing with a situation like South Africa. But we're looking at 30.7 million people, whites numbering 5.2, and then the colored group of whom I was speaking, 3.4 million, and finally the Indians at 1 million, bringing the total to 40.3 million people. Now, when we look at the Africans, the language figures showed you the great diversity within that group of people. And much of the difficulty that the rest of Africa has experienced has been based on ethnic differences and the clashes that have come up between people. You just need to mention Hutus and Tutsis to dramatize that in a very grim way. And you could multiply that time and time again across Africa. So you've got whites who are divided between English speakers like myself and the major group of whites who would be Afrikaans speakers, who have very different cultures and very different traditions. Recent times, however, have brought them together in a whole new way. Coloureds, a group that has a lot of homogeneity to it, but they too shouldn't be sort of labelled as being all the same kind of people. There's a great deal of diversity among them. And then Indians, at 1 million, may be the most homogeneous group of them all. They live mostly in one particular province and they're not really spread out throughout the country. But as one looks at the diversity that is there among the population alone, you say, how easy is it going to be for these people who have very different backgrounds to come together as one unified country? I want to touch on just a few other things before we move on to look at it more positively. Yes,
who are the colors?
Colors are people of mixed race. And those would be the people who really have been described as the only true South Africans. Because everybody else, if you go back far enough, migrated there. And the African groups came from the north, the whites came from Europe, and then the Indians came from the subcontinent of India. But the coloureds are those relatively few people who are the true products of South Africa. Okay. Three final points. One of the things to watch for as South Africa's future unfolds is the clash not so much between blacks and whites, because at one level that has been resolved. The clash, as one political analyst told us when we were there, it may well be between the poor in the urban, in the rural areas, and those people in the urban areas who, relatively speaking, have more going for them. And it may well be that it's those two groups that are going to be fighting for a share of the political pie. South Africa's resources are in fact terribly limited. South Africa, contrary to the appearances you might have, is a fairly poor country. And there is not enough to go around in the budget to provide adequate health care for everybody. There's not enough to provide adequate housing, to provide adequate schooling, and so on. And as people who are living in often desperate conditions in the rural areas are going to say, hey, where's this wonderful new nirvana that was supposed to come our way now that we blacks are in charge? What are those black leaders of ours in Pretoria giving us? We're not seeing any changes. We're not seeing the results. People in the urban areas will perhaps be more likely to benefit from the immediate flow down from government largesse. They may be the ones who will be trying to get the biggest share of the pie. And one of the things to watch for, therefore, is perhaps an increasing tension between a very large number of people in the rural areas who are extremely impoverished and saying, we want more. And the people in the urban areas, also extremely grim conditions at times, saying, we're here too and we want more. And that may well be a divide in the future. One of the other things that South Africa is well aware of as a need to deal with is expectations versus reality. And as the election was building up in 1994, many of the people in the African National Congress of President Mandela were going around saying, now we've got to be patient, things aren't going to change overnight, it's going to take a long while before you can expect to see significant changes. At the same time they were doing that, they were of course wanting to promise that the world would be wonderful once they'd come to power. That's how they would get the vote. Now that they've been in office for a year, the African National Congress has for the most part not been able to effect any significant changes, and I think most people would have expected that there wouldn't be dramatic change. But for the overwhelming majority of South Africans, the real test is going to come in 4 years' time. The government, by law, under the existing constitution, has to come up with a new election by the end of a five-year period. And the question is, what will it have accomplished by then? Because I think that the real test for South African democracy is not what happened a year ago. It's going to be what happens at the second election. Anyone can be democratic once. The question is, can you be democratic a second time, and a third, and a fourth? And Americans don't think about whether when Bill Clinton won the election in 92, whether George Bush had any real thoughts about declaring a coup and taking the military and saying, this is not an acceptable outcome, I am declaring a national emergency and we will remain in power. The election was a fraud and I'm going to remain in control as president. Americans sort of find that to be a comical prospect because of the tradition of change you have in this country. And if in next year's election Clinton is voted out of office, he will accept that, at least on the surface, with good grace, and will accept that as being part of the game. If he beats his Republican opponent, the opponent will presumably accept that with good grace and say that's the way the system is. South Africa doesn't have that habit, doesn't have that legacy. And as one looks at the expectations of what's going to take place, are lives going to be better? Because if they aren't, people might get terribly impatient and say, we've been hungry long enough. We don't give a damn about this democratic stuff. We want government that will get results. And that is going to be a crucial test of the country's stability as it moves into a new era. Of course, paramount to whether that will work well is the economic prosperity, and I don't need to say anything more about that. Now, I do want to give you a couple of examples from elsewhere in Africa that I think are illustrative. The situation in the Congo in 1960 was one that many white South Africans refer to, and it's one that is a tragic episode of how independence in Africa went wrong, because at that time of transition, the indigenous people were terribly ill-equipped to run a country. And in the build-up to that election, some interesting work was done by some researchers. And here's one historian at the time who quoted a Zairean villager as saying, after independence, there will be no taxes. Everyone will have plenty to eat, lots of clothes, cars to drive. Everything will be wonderful. And South Africans have worked hard at trying to show people, or to especially encourage people to recognize, it's not all going to be nirvana once that election of 94 occurred. The first year has proven this to be correct. Everything isn't wonderful in South Africa. If anything, taxes have increased. People still don't have everything they want, and they're not going to in the next 5 years either. The question, therefore, is, can expectations be brought to a realistic level without making people despairing and leading perhaps to a rejection of the overall system that's being worked out? Another view, a much more sober one, from the Belgian Congo at the time of 1960 was, a villager who said, probably things will be better, but it's hard to know what will happen. And that is the kind of standard or attitude that I think more realistic South Africans are embracing. The final thing I would mention is a legacy from Africa that is a very unhappy one, and that is, democracy generally has not done well on the continent. And many white pessimists have long said we're all doomed if we get a black government here. Blacks are somehow incapable of running democratic systems. And blacks themselves are well aware of the failures of Africa elsewhere. We spoke with African National Congress officials who said, we've lived in exile. We've been in countries that have been terribly run. We've learned many lessons from seeing how not to do things in government. And they are well aware of this legacy of failure from the rest of Africa. And the real test is whether those people who are of goodwill and who are wanting to make the system work can overcome what is a considerable dead weight of failure, as the rest of Africa has struggled with concepts of democracy as the Western world would know it. So I've given you a fairly sobering list of why South Africa is going to struggle as it seeks to accomplish some sense of national unity. But that's only part of the picture. And I want to now identify some aspects that are encouraging and are much more optimistic. The first one is the question of territory. And it's very important in the context of South Africa's history to understand that South Africa is now one national unity at the geographical or at the physical level. And I want to show you this map which details the homelands. You can see all these little chunks of territory here. These were the homelands that I mentioned a few minutes ago. And it was those areas that, in terms of South African law, were sovereign, independent states. The rest of the world paid no attention to what they saw as something of a farce, or indeed a tragicomedy. But if you looked at the homeland of the Transkei, for example, which is down here, South Africa, the country, saw Transkei as an independent, sovereign state with whom it exchanged ambassadors and gave lots of foreign aid each year. They saw it as something that was now separate territory. That was an ideology that was never bought into by people in the African National Congress or most of the people opposing the apartheid system. They said that the government of the National Party, which devised this grand scheme of apartheid, had absolutely no right to carve up South Africa in that way, and that all of South Africa would be coming together in the post-apartheid era. And that is indeed what has happened. Fortunately, all of these chunks of traditional South Africa are now one united territory. Don't confuse the territory of Swaziland, which is an independent country, or the territory of Lesotho, which is also an independent country. Those are encapsulated, really, by South Africa, but they are quite separate states. All of traditional South African territory, then, is now one country. And that is, psychologically at least, very advantageous for the leadership of the country. They are now in charge of one chunk of land that they have to administer. The complexities of the apartheid era with all these different scattered bits of land are now behind them. You compare that, for example, with your country, with the United States, the ongoing battle about states' rights and how you balance federal authority with state authority doesn't in any way affect the reality that this is one sovereign country. And it gets complicated when you look at places like Puerto Rico, but there's no doubt that Alaska and Hawaii are all part of the United States. South Africa's history is very different, and it needs therefore to be emphasized that now, with this one chunk of territory, the things are much more favorable and augur well for a greater sense of national unity. The second thing is the question of sovereignty. There were many charges made with the question of the legitimacy of the previous government. And while legally there was no doubt that the South African government until 1994 was a legally authorized government, there were most people around the world questioned its moral standing as a legitimate government. Now, people are entitled to question neither. The government is legitimately elected, it is constitutionally elected, and it also has the moral mandate from the people in the country that it never did before. And now you have a president in the form of Nelson Mandela who is the duly elected person in charge of the country. And what has been fascinating for us to see is how white South Africans have increasingly embraced him as their president. A very tiny number of white South Africans voted for the African National Congress. It was really a minuscule proportion of the whites who voted for Mandela's party. But after the election, it is quite clear that they have embraced him as our president. And he told a telling anecdote on visiting a church in a very conservative part of the country some months after he'd become president. He had people coming up to him, wanting to get his autograph and wanting to shake hands and so on. And he said afterwards how the problem I had today was with people, with my bodyguards needing to protect me from people wanting to admire me and wanting to get close to me, whereas just 5 years ago, I would have had these same people wanting to come and lynch me. And it is an incredible transformation in the psychology of white South Africans, at least, to see how they now see him as their duly elected president and their duly elected leader. This is crucially important as a stepping stone for the country in its attempt to consolidate those democratic values that are now beginning to take place or have begun to take place. There's several other things that are working to South Africa's advantage, not the least of which is religion. The great majority of South Africans have an adherence to Christianity. About three quarters of them do. And the church has always been very influential in the life of the country. It will continue to be influential. And so whether one is talking about an Afrikaner who may be on the more conservative side of things, or whether you're talking about an English-speaking white who may be more liberal, or whether you're talking about a colored from Cape Town, or a Zulu from the Natal area, those people may have great differences, but they may share a common faith. And the church, I don't want to oversimplify things, has been an instrument of division as well as an instrument of unity in the past, and it will continue to be that. But the point I am making is it has the potential to unify people, to show people that we have a common set of values and a common understanding of certain things that can help us pull together. Another common factor for the country would be language, and that is the question of what language is the country actually going to use now that they've attained this post-apartheid era, arrived in this era? And that would be, without doubt, the question of the language would be English. If you'll excuse the pun, English is going to be the lingua franca for the country. And the reason is that it is a neutral language compared with Afrikaans. Afrikaans, as the language of the ruling national party, was very much a hated language of the oppressor. Now, blacks can use English as a neutral language, and it's terribly convenient that it is also the language of international commerce, it's the language of diplomacy. Anyone who is an educated black has sought to learn English and to learn it well. Because if you're going to be doing any kind of business dealings in South Africa, you're increasingly going to need to know English. And if you're going to be interacting with anyone outside the country, English is going to be the language of doing so. And it was interesting when the negotiations were taking place between the then government and African National Congress people, you had people whose home language may have been Zulu or another language, talking with a person who is Afrikaans speaking, and all the work would have been done in English. And English is that neutral territory that provides now some sort of commonality for people. Education has great promise for helping to unify people. Under the previous system, there were a great number of different educational systems, and now it's unclear exactly how it's going to be working out. But there's much more promise for a unified system of education that's going to have black and white kids learning the same things, that will get similar history lessons, for example, that will help the country have a common understanding of what it's all about. There are great debates going on about what kind of educational system South Africa should have, but whatever is going to emerge, it will surely be one that will affect more people similarly than the old system did. sport is an area that will be of great help in unifying the country. South Africans are just as insane about sport as Americans are. And when you think of what it's like for this country, when you've got a Dan Jansen at the Olympic Games getting a gold medal, this country, regardless of where you are in the country, regardless of your background, people in this country root for one of our own who is doing well in that area. And so it was with South Africa's re-entry into the Olympic Games. And very interestingly, in the past several weeks, South Africa has won a major rugby festival, an international rugby tournament, which they were not regarded as having much chance of doing very well in. They ended up beating the much vaunted New Zealanders in the final, in a match that apparently had the country quite hysterical. And it wasn't just whites who've been the ones who traditionally have played rugby. Apparently this was a thing that sort of got the whole country caught up in a sense of national pride that our people, even though they're mostly whites on the field, there was one black player on the team, it's our people who are doing well. And this is the kind of thing that is going to be a potential symbol of national unity. It's no accident that Nelson Mandela himself, who's probably never played rugby in his life, went along to the team before the match and wished each of them well, and he was seen in the media having been associated with the team, him giving his blessing on this event of national unity. It was very important symbolically for the country to have something like this to pull them together. Other areas in which the country can be seen to develop a common culture would be, of course, in the marketplace, where the dollar, or its equivalent in South Africa, has no skin color. And people of all backgrounds are going to be working on, as they have in the past, on common ground in the marketplace. The economy is going to be crucially important in helping to shape some sense of national unity. The media have a great role to play in terms of forging some kind of new South African identity, some sort of commonality there. There's a lot that's been done in the area of establishing a Bill of Rights in South Africa. The new constitution has one, and there is a constitutional court that, equivalent to the Supreme Court, is now beginning to look at things like the Bill of Rights. And very recently they made their first major decision, which was on the death penalty. And the court unanimously rejected the death penalty as being inhumane, and that would be unacceptable. And it's these kinds of attentions to human rights that in the past were completely unenforceable in South Africa, given the legal system, that will help in some ways treat all people equally, or at least in theory will assure all people equal rights. The final thing that I would mention ties to the definition we looked at a little while ago, and that is a nation being a group of people who have a sense of common destiny. And one of the things that has been fascinating to witness over the past year, year and a half, has been the sense that whatever we are as South Africans, we are in this together. We've got to make it work. And that all the violence that has marked our past, all the hatred, all the animosities, we've got to put behind us. We've now got to deal with where we are. And I could give you one example after the other of people who've come together, who've said we've got to put those animosities behind us. We've got to now build from today onwards. We've got to move ahead. And it's in that sense that South Africans are moving ahead and forging some kind of common destiny. I want to conclude by making just a few final observations and then quoting someone whom I think summarizes very well the prospects for South Africa. The first thing I would say is that there is a slim chance for any kind of cohesive national unity to emerge tomorrow. It's going to take a while for this to happen, given that serious list of difficulties I mentioned. Those kinds of problems aren't going to be overcome easily, if ever. But I'm optimistic enough as I look at the positives that there is indeed a strong prospect for South Africa to put together some kind of unity that will mark its people and its national character. In the short term, people may have to settle for coexistence rather than any genuine sense of community or oneness. But in the long haul, there's indeed a good prospect. If the economy works out well, if there are improvements in the whole area of democracy, if that takes root, if it takes hold, and we do have a fair and an open election in 4 years' time, and the country seems to be stable politically and economically, the chances of that national unity taking hold are, I think, fairly good. One of the things I would say is that it's going to happen not only slowly, but it will be taking place in a very complex way. There's no one force at work that's going to lead South Africans to say on one particular morning, oh good, we woke up today feeling we have a sense of national unity. It's too amorphous a concept for you to say it's now arrived. We now have this sense of unity. It will take time for that to happen. The other thing that I would encourage you to bear in mind is that it's going to happen in ways that are uniquely South African or uniquely African. They will do democratic elections in a way that are African. They won't be the way in which you're used to voting. And they will go along to the polls next time, probably once again, with some kind of indelible ink on their hands that you cannot see, but is visible under an ultraviolet machine. And that's how they will do their elections, because the great majority of people voting are illiterate. And they will do things their way. They will develop a sense of unity in ways that may surprise Westerners, or Westerners may find very odd. And the final thing is that whatever changes are going to take place will inevitably come from the South Africans themselves. It's they who will have to put together this own and their own understanding, their own sense of who their heroes are, who their leaders are, what is the commonality that we share. What is it that makes us South Africans, regardless of all these differences that we have? A political scientist whom we met when we were back there was looking ahead to the election that was just 3 or 4 months away. And he said, well, as he looks at this election, he would be cautiously optimistic as to how it's going to work out. He said, I'm going to say cautiously optimistic, because if it falls to pieces and it ends in chaos, I can tell you I was being cautious. If it works out well, I can tell you I was optimistic. And so I would, in some ways, hedge my bets as well by saying I'm cautiously optimistic that that kind of promising future can be attained. But I would be more on the optimistic side than on the cautious side. And I'd conclude with a quotation from a young woman named Beatie Hoffmeyer, who is an activist in human rights work. And before the election, she said the following, and I think her remarks ring true even today. My confidence about the future stems from the firm belief that we are capable of patriotism, that we have the desire for peace and justice, the hunger for a better future, and the leaders to take us there. Thank you.